Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. We are broadcasting live from the Heritage Radio Network Teepee at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival. Our guests are Rob Mondavi Jr. and Rick Rubel. Rob Mondavi Jr. is a fourth generation winemaker born into one of the most famous wine families in the world. Rob worked in wine sales and cigars, right?
We gotta love the cigars.
Before joining the family business around 2000, he joined the winemaking team around 2004 and took over wine leadership in 2012. Rick Rubel is an award-winning, iconic sommelier at Charleston Grill and a friend of Heritage in the show. He oversees their massive wine program of over 1,300. How many bottles? Is that a good
number? Yeah, 13, 1,400.
The nice thing about Rick is he's not an old guy, but he's also mentored a generation of Charleston sommeliers who we were talking about earlier are also making their mark around town. All right, thank you for joining us, Rick and Rob. There's the possibility Preston Van Winkle may stop by, but that may not happen. So let's get right into it. Rob, you know, I wanted to ask you something. I'm very curious about this. You're the fourth generation of a legendary wine family, and, you know, that's not to be taken lightly. Growing up around all that history and just seeing everything happen, what compelled you at some point to sort of jump into the business? Because I don't know, and you'll explain this to me. I don't know if you started in it, left, or you started, you know, in the wine part and then went in. And give me just a little quick path to where we are today.
So the nickel tour, how the heck do we get here, right?
Right.
So you're right. You're born into a fourth generation wine family. It's remarkable. But when you grow up in Napa Valley, everyone's, you know, a second, third, or fourth generation winemaker or involved with a great restaurant.
There's no doubt. I'm going to give you the props. I mean, the Mondavi name is sort of royalty, you know.
It helps get you a table booking, and that $5 will get you a cup of coffee.
That's all you care about, right?
So I'll tell you what, though. But it was amazing growing up in Napa Valley because you're with the vines, you're with agriculture. We have great farm-to-table foods there just as a way of life. But as you're moving through this, you ask the question, now, how did you get into wine? So I did start early, and I started early because I love to duck hunt. And I took the car out when I was about 11, 12 years old, and I got stuck in the mud, and I burned out the transmission on the ranch there. And when I burned out the transmission, I didn't have permission to take the car.
Oh,
and
boy.
My dad said, "You're paying for it." And so I started working in the cellars to pay off the debt for the transmission because I wanted to go and grab some ducks. So
but
that's how I started.
That sounds more forced than, you know, I had this burning passion to be in the wine business.
Well, at 12 years old, you know, yeah, blowing off a couple shotgun shells is very different than, you know. I'm going to sit down and pontificate over a Cabernet Sauvignon at 12.
Right.
But that was the genesis, and I found that I loved it. I loved being in the cellar, the sights, the smells, the timing of things, the hurry up and get the barrels ready. And it's just the aromatics. I can always remember the aromatics of my first barrel that I ever filled and that just lovely, toasty richness.
That was the oak and the wine and everything.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Yeah. It's just phenomenal. So that's where you started to really fall in love is when you had that opportunity to work there. And then time in the vineyards growing up was lovely. And time in the vineyards, I worked in the vineyards and pruned and worked on tractors and the whole bit. It was great.
But then at some point, you leave?
Well, at some point, yeah. I definitely,
as you get older, I mean, let's go a little later.
Yeah, you go through your internships and all that. And we had a great rule in our family business. The family wanted 5 years outside industry experience, outside a winery experience. So for me, I went out and I worked a little bit with Southern Wine Spirits.
Which is a huge distributor.
Distribution house. And it was great. They gave me my first formal job.
Were you doing sales?
Absolutely, I was doing sales. And I was servicing, we have gas stations, kind of like your Parker's here in the Southeast, called Cheaper. And so that was my route.
Oh,
I was
boy.
Servicing gas
wow,
stations.
That's cutting your teeth.
Yeah, but it was great, though. You know, I was selling vodka and you know, Kessler whiskey by the you know, 375 jugs, and I mean, were they 1.5 liter jugs? It was great.
So you do that. You did a little thing with cigars, which I mentioned.
Now the cigar.
What was
era.
The compulsion there? I mean, you're a cigar smoker.
So this is pretty cool. So Ted Simpkins, who was a Southern Wine Spirits guy, was over at at my folks' house for dinner, and George Hamilton was there, the Tan Man himself,
who graced the cover of Cigar Aficionado very early on.
Yeah. Well, you know, he had cigar bars in Vegas, right?
Didn't know that.
It was amazing. And so George says, this is right when cigars are starting to peak. And I was living down in Panama City, Panama, next to the equator, not Florida. And and sure enough, George says to me, you need to go and get some tobacco. Make some cigars. You're down in Central America. Go to Nicaragua. Go to Dominican. And I said, well, what the... I don't know anything about it. He says, you know cigars. You know, it's blending, it's flavor profiles, you've smoked cigars. He says, here's a couple contacts. And then when you get your cigars ready, he looks at Ted, says, Ted will distribute them in California and I'll sell them in my place in Vegas. And off I went.
Now, were you a casual cigar smoker or?
I was a casual cigar smoker at the
time.
So,
I mean, you knew what you liked. You knew cigars. That wasn't.
Yeah, you know, the
business,
lore of the Cubans.
The business of cigars was just, you know, new to you and all that.
Yeah.
So you did that for a few years, though, right?
I did that for just about 6 years.
Wow, that's a long time.
And it was remarkable. And thank the Lord, the liver does regenerate because I tested it fully.
Man, you're in two crazy businesses, cigars and wine. I mean, you need a cleanse like once a year or something.
Maybe more than that back in the day.
So you why do you back out of the cigar thing?
Well, a few reasons to back out of the cigar industry. First and foremost, as we saw the cigar, the boom and bust, right?
Right.
That really hit at the end of 1999
2000, right.
and 2000. So that was the perfect time. I had spent 5.5 years outside in that business, worked with Southern Wine Spirits, and really had a lovely run, understanding business, making some money, losing some money, because at the end of the cigar craze, you know, we had inventory we had to get rid of. And it's probably the best lesson was actually losing some money. But then, right. Then it was the right time to close up shop there, and had applied for a position at the winery, and the position that they had open at the time was in Atlanta, Georgia, in sales, and so they said, if you want a job, you can go to Atlanta or you can wait.
So you settled down here.
So
in
I
the
went
south.
To Atlanta.
There you go. So yeah, that was sort of the entree into that. We'll come back to you. But, Rick, I wanted to ask you, you know, a little about your background. You've been in the market. You've been at a legendary restaurant. I mean, you're one of the true influencers in wine in the market. You've been at Charleston Place, Charleston Grill, how long?
Gosh, about 12 years.
It's been that long.
Yes.
Just quickly, get me to what got you there. I mean, what were you doing before? Obviously, you had some passion with wine. You were working.
Yeah, I was the opposite of Rob. I did not grow up
normal.
I did not grow up in a wine family. For me, you know, wine was maybe a bottle of Asti Spumante for the holidays, or maybe something German on the table. But for the most part, it was, you know, cocktails around the house for the grown-ups. And so wine was not part of my culture at all. I worked in restaurants through college, and a girlfriend of mine at the time took a summer abroad program in London. And I was like, wow, that's too far away. And I wanted to be closer. I had met somebody that offered me a job as a cellarman in the south of England at a Glyndebourne Opera House in the south of England. So I took it. I didn't know what a cellarman was. I didn't know what £2.75 was, but it sounded good to me. Took it, and I found out £2.75 spent like about $2.75. Didn't go very far, but I was working like 100 hours a week, and so things were fine. And I found out a cellarman was basically just to keep the cellar clean, stock it up, which was fine too. I was 21.
Got to break in somewhere.
I got to 10 bar at night, and there they just give you drinks rather than tips, which was fine for me.
So kind of self-taught from there on?
Yeah, but I also had to open 200 wines a day and taste them, make sure they weren't corked. And so I started tasting things like Chateau Palmer, Le Morachet, and got to cut my
teeth. A lot of Bordeaux and Burgundy.
Yeah, it was England, so it was all French.
Right.
I think Sterling was the only California wine out there. And
not even Mondavi, huh?
Not yet.
Wow, not yet.
So it was fantastic. I got to cut my teeth on classics, and they just handed me a book and started studying about what the different vineyards were, and I fell in love with wine. Fast forward a couple years later, worked in restaurants in Michigan, and the company I was working for hired the first female master sommelier, Madeline Trefon, legend. You know, amazing woman to this day. And I worked with her for 10 years, opening up every type of restaurant you could possibly imagine,
great
from
experience.
Mexican to high-end steakhouses.
That's great. So you came to Charleston Grill, what, early 2000s?
2006.
Okay, 2006. Yeah. All right, Rob, I'm going to jump back to you because we left it where you came back into the business, took the job in Atlanta, but at some point, I guess around 2000-ish, or was that too, when did you get back sort of home? Napa, so, around the family.
So I spent 2 years in Atlanta, 2000 to 2002, okay. Working sales. And what a great area, because I got to cover the Southeast.
Atlanta's a cool market.
Oh, Atlanta's a cool market. You got to go to Nashville and Birmingham, of all places, drinks out almost every other place in their import and luxury tier wines. I don't know what's going on there, but they got something going on. Frank Stitt and Chris Hastings, those crazy guys over there. And so in 2002, I was called back to Napa Valley, and for whatever reason, they put me in touch in charge of the hospitality center. So all the visitor tours, tastings, the trade tastings, the small private kitchen we have there, and they said, have fun swimming in the deep end. And
they knew they were throwing you in.
Oh, it was great. But you know, this was home for me. This is where we grew up.
Right.
So even though I hadn't formally worked, in the hospitality area, minus doing tours and tastings, I did grow up in Napa Valley. And how I also made some money on the side was I would work catering gigs, and I was way too clumsy to ever be on the floor. So they put me in the back prepping. And thank God I had some knife skills that allowed me to be in the back prepping. But God, they never let me near the floor. I was still a klutz, and I love it.
So you do that, and then about 2004, does that make sense? 2004, you really jump into everything. You start getting into winemaking, more of the product.
Exactly. So a few things happened between 2003 and 4. In 2003, I started a small brand called Medusa that focused on Zinfandel with a couple friends, and it was really, really small. It was just a couple hundred cases, and that was fun. Love making Zin, great esoteric.
Where did you source the grapes from?
Child's Valley? Outside the family. Did all this outside the family. And then in 2004, we had one of the toughest years for the family ever, because the company was publicly traded at the time.
Right.
And then the company sold.
Right.
So Dad and I left before it sold. We didn't feel as if we could right the ship, so to speak, for the direction we wanted.
And your dad is Michael Mondavi.
My dad's Mike Mondavi,
Robert's son, right.
Mm-hmm. And then we left in June, and then the company ended up closing and selling in December of that year.
And a whole different path started after that.
Oh.
Which we'll get into. But what I want to talk, Rick, I just wanted to ask you, during your tenure, and I'm going to ask you the same thing, Rob, during your tenure at Charleston Place, which you said is a dozen years, you've seen a lot of change in wine, in Charleston, in the market.
Yeah.
You know, observationally, you know, what have you seen change?
You know, I think it's almost getting more kind of schizophrenic. You've got two totally different buying communities that are looking for different things. You've got kind of younger, natural, higher acid, lower alcohol.
Is wine. That the millennial market?
Millennial market, yes.
Different taste than the traditional market.
And not so brand focused, right? More kind of like social group focused. What's going on? What's happening? And a fun community ready to try all kinds of different things. People now ask for esoteric grape varieties and funky flavors, which is great, but you also have a whole other community that's still drinking bigger, rich wines. So, you know, I love all of
but
it.
But does and that I love mean a place like Charleston Place, Charleston Grill, which is, it's fair to say, a traditional restaurant.
Right.
Do you start slotting more natural wines or, you know, millennial-oriented wines, or you don't have to?
No, I mean, the great thing about having 1,300 wines is I don't have to limit them.
Right.
And I'm a wine geek, right? I love all that stuff. But I'm also, you know, not young anymore. So, you know, I want to give people what they love. And so it's not about trying to force what I love onto other people. It's really trying to figure out what they're into. And if they want natural wine and high acid, low alcohol, funky, off flavors, we've got that. I love those too. And yeah, a little bit of it.
You could handle all of that.
Yes.
Rob, the changes you saw, I mean, obviously you grew up around the family. And when you came to 2004, I mean, that's about as big a change as any. The business changes hands. But I didn't realize. I mean, I knew. But you and your dad got the hell out of there.
Right.
So, you know, I think your dad and, you know, you at this point became very astute business guys. You started your own branding, importation, a bunch of things. That was the change for you there. But that was also the beginning, right?
Right. That was the best jumping off point ever. So the family business, the Robert Mondavi Winery, was publicly traded in 2004. It sells. Dad and I were out before the end of the sale. And we started.
Did that literally get you away from all the aggravation and press and nonsense of the sale and the family bullshit and politics and all of that?
You know, I don't think you ever get away from the family BS and politics, because that's part of, you know, family, right? We all have the crazy cousins and the nieces and nephews. But it really, it makes it great, because you know where you're going to stand at any given time throughout the duration of time with a family business. And you may have different points, but you know at the end of the day, your oars are in the water and you're headed for the same general direction. And that's what's beautiful about that. But I got to tell you what, it was a big change, but it was the best change, because that's where I had the opportunity to go back into winemaking. Because I'd been a cellar rat, worked vineyards, worked in the winery. And my wife said, look, I love you no matter what you're going to do here, but you got to figure out where you're happiest. And I usually would spend time with Jean-Vieve, our winemaker in the cellar, and with my Uncle Tim. And she said, when you would spend any periods of time with the winemaking team, you always came home more energized and happier than no matter what you sold or what you marketed.
So she was a big influence helping you focus.
Yep. And so that's
following your passion and where you should be.
That's where I made a tack
change. Kudos to her.
And had to catch up. That's why for 8 years, I worked with my mentor, and then after 8 years of really catching up and focusing, then I took over the winemaking team. So part of it when we started, and now I'm in charge of it.
So let's talk. Rob brought some wine in, which we're going to taste.
Nice.
I'm not letting that go to waste. Rick and I, and, you know, we'll all grab a glass. Let's talk about specifically, you know, what you've been working on. The Mondavi family wines. Let's talk about, there's a bunch of different, I don't know if the word's level, but, you know, in the portfolio. I mean, you make a high-end wine, you make, talk to me about what's going, let's talk first, what are we drinking? We're drinking a Chardonnay.
Right here, we're drinking our new label. It's called Emblem Chardonnay. And you guys will love this. Petaluma Gap, brand new appellation this year. And
I mean, literally designated as an AVA?
I didn't have enough knowledge ahead of time to know that the AVA would be approved in January of this year. So this says Sonoma on the label, but it's 100% from within Sonoma County, within a beautiful little area of Petaluma called the Petaluma Gap. So you have this beautiful mountain range with crunchy earth under the feet, lots of stones. And you'll notice I'm trying to do something a little bit different here with Chardonnay. I like acid in wine.
It's good for food.
It's good for food. Good for me.
Right.
So this is always what's best to do is, so instead of me talking about my wine, I'm going to put it back.
I was going to throw it to you too. So Rick, our trained sommelier, I want you to let's do an assessment in here. So on the color, it's kind of a golden yellow.
Yeah, so you're definitely looking at either something that's got some sunshine or some age to it. And obviously this Sonoma has a little bit of both of those, but not overly oaked. Certainly some new French.
We have about 25% new French oak on here, and I like that percentage. Excuse me, this was 20. The 2015 was 25. It was too much. We brought it down to 20%. Yeah. I love the viscosity from oak, but you know, I want to taste these darn grapes in here.
And great acidity, as you're talking about. I mean, that's what jumps out.
So let's go nose. What are we getting on the nose? We're gonna do color, nose, mouth feel, and we're gonna do palate.
So
and we're gonna buzz through them because we want to get to the red.
Nose to me is certainly some of those vanilla cinnamon characteristics coming from the oak, but back in there, it's more tree fruit to me.
Agree, maybe. Rob?
No, I completely agree.
Okay.
I look for the fruit in there as well. I get a little bit of that kind of sliced fresh nectarine, which I really like.
Yeah, like not overly ripe nectarine, mm-hmm. right? Almost green nectarine.
Yeah, so, like the nice firm. I don't like respectfully, I don't like slutty fruit. I like it to be a little firm, a little acidic.
Citrus, tree fruits.
You shouldn't
fruits.
Like slutty anything, but we'll move on. Let's go mouthfeel.
Mouthfeel, 1 second.
I think I blushed.
I would say it's medium, medium plus. Got a nice mouth coating.
Yeah, it's Chardonnay, and it's certainly not shy of alcohol. I mean, medium alcohol. What, 13-ish or something?
Yeah, we're going to get 13, 6, 7 on this bottle.
Under 14.
Yeah, so, absolutely under 14.
So very. So it's got some body to balance that
so
acidity.
We're picking a little bit before everybody else that picks in the same vineyard that we buy from. This is one of the only vineyards that we buy fruit from. So we're in Napa Valley, where we have most of our vineyards, except I don't have the right terroir, soil climate, to grow Chardonnay. So we decided to go into Sonoma County and up into the Petaluma Gap to find our Chardonnay.
All right, so let's finish up on this wine. You alluded to it, five more minutes, you alluded to it earlier. The grapes are grown in Petaluma. What's the soil? What are the characteristics being pulled out of the ground, literally?
There's some shale. Which is really neat to see, because when it rains there, you can walk into the vineyards, and instead of it sticking to your feet, it's crunchy. And that's really important to me, because I have a rocky soil profile, and I think that's where we get a little minerality.
The shale definitely gives it minerality.
Yeah, definitely a lot of minerality. It's delicious.
So this is readily available?
No, the wines we're tasting today, we have in limited production. Okay. This is only one. Let me see. I think of everything in tons, because I'm a wine geek. This is 950 cases.
So if somebody was interested, they would go website-wise, they would go where?
They can go to michaelmondavi.com. So named for my father, michaelmondavi.com.
And all the wines are there, and you could see emblem. Do you do wine clubs? Do you do mailing lists?
We have wine club, mailing lists. We're actually starting a new program where we're having a curated club. Because I'm so tired of hearing about clubs where you get sent everything under God's green earth, right. No winemaker makes. So we're actually having a dialogue with the people in our club and discovering what do you like. So I know that they're going to want more Chardonnay. And if they like the acid Chardonnay, then we'll talk to them about Sauvignon Blanc. And so we're really trying to make this special for them. And I just don't want to send them everything under God's green earth.
It's not about the club. It's about giving people what they want.
Exactly.
Which I like. All right. So we're going to wrap up soon. But before we do, let's taste the red. Is the red open? Rick, you open
that? The red is open and ready to go.
Let's taste the red. Let's give that assessment. Then I want to ask both of you. I always like to ask my guests some food pairing ideas. What you guys think go well with this?
With the white...
Yeah, let's start with the Chard. So if you had a classic wine and food pairing...
You know, mushroomy, creamy pastas would be fantastic to me. I think with the acidity, I think lobster, especially if you've got a little dose of saffron or something.
Rob,
in there
that sounds
to play
good,
off
right? A little lobster and some emblem?
Yeah, that...
What else?
Kind of the characteristics I'm looking for. Richer seafood, I think, would be...
I was going to say, like lobster with butter. It would hold up
butter
and cream.
All. Yeah.
All right, so we're moving to red. Rob, what are we drinking? An emblem red.
So we're sticking with the emblem theme. So the emblem Cabernet and Sauvignon and Chardonnay are really our two staples. And the Cabernet Sauvignon comes from our home ranch. So one of the first things we did when we got started up again is we bought vineyards. And we bought a beautiful 270-acre parcel with about 110 acres planted. Cabernet Sauvignon from hillsides and also sweeps down to the valley floor. But why would I mention that? Why is that even important to have hillsides and valley floor? Hillsides typically have smaller berries, more texture, more intensity. And then the valley floor, the berries tend to be bigger because there's more nutrients down there in the valley floor.
So you blend.
So a little bit softer. So I can blend my hillside Cabernet and my valley floor Cabernet with a little bit, and this is what I love to do, with a little bit of Petite Syrah. That gives that beautiful violet petal, flower petal aromatic, and the blueberry.
Definitely. When I taste it, I'm like, yep, this is not a pure, you know.
Definitely not pure.
Definitely gives it a little interesting nuance to
it. Is this all estate fruit? Is this from up in that eastern slopes?
Slopes. We have a few percent from off of our ranch because I didn't grow Zinfandel, and there's about 1% of Zinfandel in here. I wanted some black pepper in the aromatics, and then there's just a little Syrah that I pull out of Dry Creek. So it's about... 94.5% estate, and thereafter it's not.
Gotcha.
So on the color, it's you know, it's got that purple dark violet, but it's not that deep opaque. It's got a nice color, you know, in the light. So color wise, beautiful. On the nose, Rick?
On the nose, it's mostly a lot of blue fruits, but black fruits and a little bit of red fruit, like blackberries, plums, red raspberries in there as well, kind of gives it a lift.
How about mouthfeel?
Mouthfeel, to me, this is classic Napa Cabernet. So the, I don't know
plus,
what percentage.
You know, mouth filling?
Yeah, medium plus, if not full body. This is probably 14 plus.
Yeah, this is like 14 and change. So we're talking 14 and change alcohol. It's like 14.3, 14.4 alcohol.
Not too crazy, though.
No, you know, and I like to have some balance in wine. But believe me, I want it to be modern. There's so many great Cabernets in Napa Valley. How do I make a point of differentiation?
This is a modern style, for sure.
So that's where we bring in the Petit Sirah.
Color-wise, the blend, the taste. I mean, you nailed it there.
This is our Monday through Thursday.
Right. And then, Rick, give me some taste descriptors.
Nice tannin structure, right? So it's there. It'll hold up nicely to a steak.
What vintage year?
This is 2014.
14.
So oh, what a killer vintage. Yeah.
Was it a killer vintage on the field?
It was easy.
You had a stretch of nice vintages, yeah.
All right, so, Rick, what are we pairing with now?
Well, all I can smell is
it's fair to
like,
say this is a modern, you know, cab sauv from California, not the classic.
I'm smelling all kinds of fire-roasted grilled food out here, which is making me hungry for a nice steak on the grill, something absolutely fantastic. Pour this with something like that would be...
You know, right behind the tent, we have Sea Island Grills.
Right.
And you can smell the oak that they're burning over there coming off. I'm with you. I want a ribeye that has a nice low smoke to start with, like on a Traeger. And then I want to sear off and get that caramelization.
Yeah. Simple food to go with this, I think it would be fantastic.
Yeah. So this is the 2014 emblem.
Yes, it is.
Just give me some percentages. Cab, it's about how much?
Cab, let's work backwards. So you got 1% Zinfandel, just for a little cracked pepper. About 4% Syrah.
Okay.
And then after that, we've got about 6-7% Petit Syrah, about the same on Petit Verdot, and thereafter Cabernet Sauvignon. So you're right at about 78.5% Cabernet Sauvignon.
So instead of the classic Bordeaux blend with the 5 blending grapes, this is now the new modern California blend with everything out there that tastes good and, you know, make Zinfandel.
Yeah.
Petit, you know, all that stuff.
Well, nice. You know, winemakers have so many tools today that aren't necessarily blending tools. You know, there's these crazy tannins you can add and all this crap. I want it naturally made. So we have the opportunity to select beautiful estate-grown fruit, tenured vineyards where we buy just a smidgen from, and that to me is the way to craft wines.
That is the way.
So this same source is Animo and the... And by Michael.
All right. So what we just referred to is our luxury tier vineyard.
So quickly,
Animo.
Let's talk about. Yep. We just drank through an emblem Chardonnay and an emblem Cab Sauv. The family you're involved with makes other, you know, bottlings. Let's just go through quickly.
So this is our entry foyer, the emblem, which we just enjoyed.
What are we talking now, approximate retail? Give me Chardonnay.
Approximate retail, $40.
Okay.
So nice and easy, great price point.
But if you want to step up and spend a little more, you got a wine for me?
We can step you up. Okay. So we moved from the northeastern hills of Napa Valley, just above St. Helena by Ink Grade, where we were with Emblem. And now we're going to move about 20 miles to the south, up above Oakville, up above where Paradox is, up above the canyon there called Rector Canyon. And up on top in Atlas Peak is where we have our ranch. About 1,375 feet of volcanic elevation up there. And we produced our Animo Cabernet Sauvignon and M by Michael Mondavi. And it's dynamite.
Pretty scary summer you had.
We had a terrible summer up there. And, you know, this is the perfect time. So what we just mentioned was the fact that in Northern California, we had terrible fires this October.
Terrible.
And the news, of course, showed how sensational and terrifying it was. 70-mile-an-hour winds, flames that were over 70 and 100 feet tall. One of my buddies is a fireman told me the fire was moving at 250 feet per second on the gust.
Wow.
It was absolutely out of control. But what we didn't follow up on was to demonstrate that Napa Valley and Sonoma mainly had the hills and the open acreage burn. There are neighborhoods that sadly went, but as a visitor, you have to look to find that devastation. So as a visitor, right, when you come to Sonoma and Napa, it is beautiful.
Ready to go.
But there's ready some bad stories behind what's looking good.
Oh, absolutely.
People got hurt, displaced.
Atlas Peak was scary.
Yeah. We lost our entire vintage of 2017 Animo and M by Michael Mondavi. Yeah. The smoke damage was so bad that we decided to declassify the entire vintage.
Well, I'm glad you guys are okay. And
yeah.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to wrap up. But before we wrap up, I want to ask you guys a question because you're so deep into, you know, the liquid, you know, wine and all of that. When you're not drinking wine, not drinking Mondavi or friends' wines or whatever, I know that you're probably, like, sitting in your library drinking tea, reading a book. But when you're not doing that, what are you drinking?
This isn't like? Falcon Crest. I don't have a library.
I know.
I've got iBooks. So I'm an old guy. What do I drink? If I'm drinking other people's wines, especially out of Napa Valley.
So you like to taste through all
of them. Oh, I love drinking Napa Valley wines. But, you know, I'm a big fan of Colgan. I like Benoit Touquet's wines, you know, with Realm. I think he's crushing it. Kirk Vange's been a friend of mine forever. His wines are outlying style, which are really interesting to me. But Colgan still is one of my favorites. Good God, she just
nails it.
Didn't
they just sell the...
To LVMH.
That's right. Who owns everything else?
That
right?
Woman's going to have more handbags than she knows what to do and a great seller.
That may be why she sold it to them.
I can't think of better reasons.
I wanted to ask you, when you were growing up, obviously you said Napa Valley, all that. Was there any person in the business that you still connect to that like kind of pulled you over? You know, Rob, you know, is there somebody that you still remember was like a good guy or something?
Yeah, you know, one of the first guys I worked for in the cellar, Tony Coltrane, he started working with our family in 1972.
Wow.
I was one when he started, and he's still with us today. He transferred over from the old company to work with us.
He left
he was my
the
mentor.
Old Mondavi, and he's with you and your dad and all of that.
That's a great story.
So any non-wine stuff you like to drink?
Oh, well, our mystery guest who didn't show, where's the Pappy guy? Come on.
We were hoping to have Preston Van Winkle on, but he couldn't make it over. All right, Rick, we're going to wrap up, but tell me, Rick is a guy who's around, you know, 13,000 different kinds of wines or bottles and all of that. When you're not drinking wine, because you taste a lot, you taste on the floor, you taste, what do you like to drink?
You know,
iced tea or what?
I really enjoy a kind of ciders, especially from Normandy or something like that, dry ciders. Absolutely delicious. I'm always looking to taste something else, but if I'm just doing a cocktail day off, I love a margarita. Just fresh lime margarita or
a margarita made the right way.
If I've got money for cognac, same kind of lemon juice base.
There you go. When I'm not drinking wine, I'm drinking wine. Okay. All right, we're going to wrap up the show. I want to thank my guests. I want to thank Rob Mondavi Jr. from Michael Mondavi Family Estate. I want to thank Rick Rubel. Rick Rubel runs the wine program at the Charleston Place at the Charleston Grill. Thank you guys for joining us. Rob, thanks for taking the time. Rick, thanks for taking the time.
Sam, it's a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We've been broadcasting from the Charleston Wine and Food Festival. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
Thank you so much.